Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. Stay ahead of all the big games in the best league in the world, the Premier League. With the latest odds, form guides, expert opinions and more, the fans are the players at Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com, 18 plus, begambleaware.org. T's and C's apply.
Welcome to Upfront with Brian Dean and me, Sam Matterface, on TalkSport. This is the show that takes you into the world of the number nine as we find out what it takes to be a top-flight striker. We'll discuss what it's like to play abroad, the pressures of being a centre-forward, and how it felt to score the first ever goal in the Premier League.
Cork waiting on the edge of the six-yard area, and Dean scores! 4 minutes and 36 seconds when the ball went into the net.
You're listening to Upfront with Brian Dean and me, Sam Matterface, on TalkSport. Despite over 650 league appearances and nearly 200 league goals, and clubs ranging from Sheffield United to Leeds United, Leicester, West Ham and Perth Glory, international honours with England, 3 caps, would it be fair to say that my guest today hasn't got talked about enough as a top number nine? That's an oversight, because not only do his statistics at Sheffield United in particular hit the marks of excellence, he was a man of firsts. Brian Dean scored the first goal at the King Power Stadium, or the Walker Stadium as it was known, and he scored the first ever goal in the Premier League. Brian Dean, hello, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, very good.
Manchester United opening day of the 1992-93 season. How often do people discuss that goal with you?
Quite often, which is nice. You know, it's such a long time ago, but you know, it just seems so fresh still because obviously we start the season every August and it's the first question everybody thinks about, you know, who scored the first goal and so on. So it's always nice to revisit that that sunny afternoon in Sheffield.
And we will get to that goal in more detail very soon indeed. But I wanted to get a flavour, first of all, for those who don't have as long a memory as me, of what sort of centre-forward you were. What sort of number nine was Brian Dean?
I think my main attributes were that I was quite a tall striker, quick, you know, from a young age. I learned to use both feet. It was something that my brother drilled into me from sort of like the age of about 10 to use both feet. So I was pretty comfortable on both sides. And obviously because of my height, I was pretty decent in the air. Once I learned that the movements in the box, you know, it became a very good weapon, especially towards the end of my career when I wasn't as mobile. I think one of the things about me was I was never over-reliant on my heading ability. I was always somebody who liked to get on the shoulder of players and run and try and get an open space for a shot on either side.
You were, and you are, very tall. You're big, yep. You're strong, you're physical. What advantages do you think that gave you?
Quite a few, really, because there's a number of aspects to the game that people don't really understand when you're playing at a professional level. There's the psychology of football. I think that was another thing that I learned. You know, sometimes when you're lining up in a tunnel or so on, and you're playing against a centre-back, or, you know, it can be quite intimidating. I think I've been on the other side of the coin when I was a young kid coming into football, and I always used to be, let's say when I was at Doncaster, I was on the bench, I used to look on the pitch, I used to see the centre-half, I think, wow, he's massive. And then I'd get on the pitch and I was just as big. But it was only when I started to grow into my body, maybe around 20, 21, that I kind of realised that it can give you a psychological advantage. You know, it obviously helps you when you're talking about if you can go toe-to-toe with somebody physically, it then becomes a battle of the mind. But like I said, I had other attributes. I think I was pretty quick. I could play down the wings either side. Good engine, you know, which I think is very important. for me, one of the most important attributes of a centre forward is being mobile and being able to come short, but also be able to go over the top or down the sides of people. So I was quite gifted from that point of view, if I must say myself. You know, if I could say what attributes would you like as a centre forward, I think I'd be quite happy with what I was blessed with.
In terms of maximising those qualities, what did you what did you prefer to do? Did you prefer the fight? Did you prefer the sort of challenge of outpacing someone and getting in behind or going down the sides of the pitch? Was there something that you know, if you had the choice, what was the bit you enjoyed the most?
I enjoyed out footballing people. It was simple. I think the physical side of things, I always used to say, was there. I mean, I remember there was a couple of times where I played against people, and the first thing that a centre-half does sometimes is come down the back of you, and I gave a couple of warnings. I said, look, we can go either way if you want, because it wasn't really my choice. I preferred to think about scoring goals and getting on the end of things.
Who was the worst for doing that to you?
If you're old enough, you'll know that Steve Bould had a ridiculous reputation for going down the back of people. You know, he was a great defender, and he was one of those that I never really fully enjoyed playing against, because, you know, if you've got a physical advantage over somebody, it's great and you can relax into the game. But we were roughly the same size and build, you know, and obviously he had Tony Adams next to him and sometimes Martin Keown as well. So that side of it, you had to try and adapt to your game. Generally, I just preferred to play football. I preferred to do everything legally. And I just wanted to use my attributes to see how I could impose myself on the game.
As you've got older, you've been a manager, a team owner.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you're going to tell me now that it's all about the team and it's all about the collective. But were you one of the "it must be me who scores" brigade when you were playing, or were you always happy to sacrifice yourself for the team?
No. You know, if you're a centre forward and you're scoring goals, you want to be the one who's scoring. And I was fortunate enough at Sheffield United that they gave me that platform. You know, the way how the game was set up for us was ideal for me, in that, you know, there was plenty of things for me to run onto. They would always look for me as the first, you know, people called it long ball. But for me, if your advantages are up front, why aren't you going to use that? And that's what we did. So that was something that I kind of enjoyed, really. Is it important? Of course it's important. I'll tell you why, because there were times, even if I look back, even just as far back as the beginning of the Premier League, I guarantee you now, every centre forward, whether it's Alan Shearer, Ian Wright, Teddy Sheringham, Paul Merson, David Hurst, everybody would be looking and thinking, who scored? And I'll be honest with you.
Who's top of the charts today?
Yeah, exactly. And I'll be honest with you, if I'd scored a couple of goals and somebody else hadn't scored, then that would make me feel even better. So but we're talking about elite level players who want to be the best, and that's how we were. And I'm sure Alan Shearer, if you speak to him, you know, okay, some people might say, well, I wasn't bothered about anybody else, but of course you are. You know, no, it's just your competitive spirit.
Let's warm up with a couple of quick fire questions and get a proper sense of who Brian Dean really is. We'll avoid the Manchester United goal, because we're going to come back to that in detail in the second part. But what's your favourite goal?
I get asked this, in terms of different clubs and so on. My favourite goal at Leeds was the goal that I scored against Spurs.
Here's Brian Dean, midway inside his own half. He begins the break. Shuffles it to the left-hand side of the park. Dean still going strong. Oh, he's gone for goal! That is magnificent. Strength, power, finesse. The lot.
That got us into UEFA Cup, as it was then. I picked up the ball halfway in our own half and I ran three quarters of the length of the pitch and shot past Ian Walker, last game of the season. If I'm talking about down at Sheffield United, it's probably the goal I scored from 40 yards against Grobbelaar.
Oh, Grobbelaar's come on walkabouts. He's dispossessed. This will be spectacular if it goes in. Oh, look at that. 45 yards from Brian Dean. What was Grobbelaar thinking about?
There was loads of goals. I scored different types of goals, and I think that's the other thing. I wasn't somebody who just sat and waited in the box, you know, pulled off to the far post and nodded it down or nodded it back across. You know, my game was down the left, it was down the right. You know, that was how it was in those days. As a centre forward, you were the one who was supposed to score the goals for the team. So there was a certain type of striker. Right, you look at Ian Wright, he was quick. Les Ferdinand, strong, quick. Alan Shearer, all-round game, fantastic. The only one who was a little bit different, I think, was Teddy Sheringham, who was so clever in that he, you know, his movement was fantastic. So he was perhaps the one who was a little bit different to everybody else at the time.
Okay, so another couple of quick questions for you.
Sure.
Who's your favourite strike partner?
That's a difficult one because I have to say Tony Agana, but I also have to give a mention to Tony Yeboah, who was an unbelievable striker, and also Alan Bocic, who perhaps he was as complete a striker as you could probably get.
Here's Bocic, claiming possession in his own half. Checked to see who was near him, and the answer was nobody. Still Bocic. Chips. Oh, that's fantastic! A brilliant, brilliant goal from the Croatian.
I told my brother about Alan Bocic, and my brother said, "Oh, listen, you just need to make sure that you're in the team with him." You know, he was a fantastic player. And as it goes, you know, centre forwards go, you never want to admit that somebody is perhaps a little more equipped than you at the time. But I think that's where he was. He was a world-class striker at that time. And, you know, I was past the point where I was going to improve anymore. I was going to improve in my mind perhaps a lot more than I was going to in my mobility and so on.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, I would have to say, was Cyril Regis.
Regis taking it well on the chest, and a lovely piece of control by Regis. Oh, and what a great shot! Oh, one of the goals of the season, Cyril Regis.
For obvious reasons.
It comes up a lot, you know, yeah. Talking to strikers. It's an amazing reverence in which he is held.
Yeah. You could put Cyril into the game nowadays and he'd be worth 70, 80 million. He was that good, and he was so different. I mean, if you look at some of the clips that they've got and you see him, his physical presence on the pitch where he's got quads, he's got hamstring bulges. Everybody else was, it was like he was the only one in the gym.
Cork waiting on the edge of the 6-yard area and Dean scores. 4 minutes and 36 seconds when the ball went into the net.
Let's talk about that goal. The goal against Manchester United on the opening day of the 1992-3 season. I think I've probably watched it about 10 times in the last 12 hours. What do you remember of it?
One thing I do remember was that I was a centre-forward who liked to start the season and score a goal early, because if you look at stats, and they were basic in those times, you'd say, are you a 1-in-2, are you a 1-in-3 footballer, or, you know, are you going to score one goal every other game? You know, you had to get off to a good start. And luckily for me, at Sheffield United, I'd managed to score on the opening day of the season in all my seasons from joining them. So I just approached it in exactly the same way. But I thought, look, I need to get off. This is a new league. We started the game against Manchester United and nobody fancied us, obviously. But the one thing that we had at the time was team spirit. And a belief in our ability. And we believed that playing the better teams early season was good because they wouldn't have time to get into their stride. And that proved to be the case.
Especially after 4 minutes and 36 seconds.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, Sam. I mean, we'd worked on set pieces because we knew we weren't going to have as much of the ball perhaps as Manchester United. So we had to make every moment count, and we worked on the set pieces, on the throw-ins. Alan Cork, who is very good in his movement and always was all the way through his career, started off the pitch for his run. Cal Bradshaw had a long throw, and it caused that kind of uncertainty. In the end, it was Dennis Irwin who flicked it on, and I managed to get between Gary Pallister, Peter Schmeichel and Steve Bruce basically a diving header. Well, I'd like to call it a diving header.
Yeah,
sounds better.
It wasn't the cleanest, was it? I mean, it was a good.
It didn't come off my shoulder. No, it was clean.
No, but what I mean is, it wasn't sort of like, it was one of those where, to me, it looked like, and again, I've only been watching it again in the last few hours, and I was looking at it, I was thinking, Peter Schmeichel, one of the world's best goalkeepers, has caused himself so much grief here because he's come running towards the ball and he's got nowhere near it. Brucey looked completely disorientated by the long throw. And you've sort of just stolen in and thought, do you know what? I'm going to capitalise here. And you were just quicker and sharper and a little bit more agile than Gary Pallister. And you got there and you looped it in and that was it.
I started my run from behind Gary Pallister, so they had no idea
did you know that this was coming? Did you know that what the chaos that was going to be caused by that throw-in?
Well, you don't, because you don't know how they're going to set up. You know, they might have done a better job in the zone, but from my point of view, all I had to do was come from outside of eyesight into eyesight, and if the ball ended up in that area, that's where I was going to be.
It was so early in the game, 4:36. Did you think at the time when it hit the back of the net, this was the start of a new era? Or did it just feel like every other goal?
It just felt like every other goal, if I'm honest. I mean, obviously it's different because it was against Manchester United. But in terms of, you know, it was just, look, I've managed to score on the first game of the season. So that means that if I don't score for two more games, then I'm still 1-3. Believe me, that's how it was. Trust me. Because it's like I said, there was a real responsibility on a centre forward. It's not like now where you have midfield players running, you know, like a Frank Lampard, say, for example, who would make late runs into the box and score 20 goals a season. The centre forward was the guy who was more or less responsible. Everybody had a centre forward who they would look at and say, right, well, how much has their centre forward scored this season? And that was my responsibility. So, of course, I was playing the long game and just thinking, right, OK, that's two goals in on the first day of the season. So I've got to score in the next three games to stay ahead.
When did you realise that it was a goal of significance? Were you in a pub doing a pub quiz and someone asked the question? Or did someone ask you for an interview and discuss it with you? Or is it just something that's crept up on you over time?
It's crept up, to be quite honest. Obviously, the significance at the time, I was coming off at half-time and one of the guys said, look, that was the first goal. But, you know, I'm quite a shy person I was, not so much now. But I remember being away and there was a guy came up to me in a wine bar in Spain at the end of the season. And it was really nice, actually. And he said, oh, Brian Dean, you scored the first goal. You know, at the time, I was thinking that he was going to say something awful to me because we used to get a lot of stick like that. You know, people would just come up and try and be abusive to you. So I was on my guard and I kind of just ignored it. But then I realised that he wasn't being horrible to me. He was just saying, mate, you know, you did something significant there. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, you know, I embraced it a lot more after that.
People forget you scored another goal that day from the penalty spot.
And a mistake by Bruce. This is Alan Cork. And the referee says penalty. Dean scores with Consumides.
I'd never really took a lot of penalties. I think I took about four or five in all the time. Maybe I should have taken a lot more penalties in my time. But no, that was the... I think I might have scored the first brace of the the new season.
You scored the first of everything, didn't you?
I'm struggling now. I'm just clutching at straws.
You made your debut in 1985 for Doncaster before moving on to what was at the time a struggling third division, Sheffield United. And you fired them to promotion, back to the second and then to the first division. How much did that journey going through those leagues contribute to you becoming the number nine that you ultimately became?
Oh, it was massive. I mean, if I'm honest, when I was at Doncaster, you know, the season we got relegated, I learned a lot there. I had a great manager in Dave Cusack. You know, he gave me my debut. And playing in that league and learning the physicality of the game at the time, I think I was 19, 20, stood me in good stead. And when we got relegated, Doncaster offered me a new contract, but it was, I think the contract that they offered me was saying that we don't really want you to stay. And I was quite bullish and had a belief in my ability, and I turned down the contract. And Sheffield United came in, and I knew I could score goals in that division. You know, I'd scored 10 goals in a struggling team at 19 years of age. So I thought, well, I know I can score goals in this division. If the right club comes in for me, I know that I'll be able to contribute very well. And to be honest, I had my eye on Sheffield United because I knew they'd come down, and I felt that, you know, if I could just go in there and kind of not make too many waves at the beginning, it would give me time to settle down, and then I could really start coming to the fore. But fortunately for me, it started off really well in pre-season. There was Derek Dooley was the chairman, and Derek used to come on all the trips with us to Sweden and so on in pre-season. And I think it was the combination of the players, the warmth from Derek Dooley in particular, who took me under his wing, the man management of Dave Bassett and the staff, Derek French and Jeff Taylor. It just felt like the right thing and the right place to be for me.
Dean with a header. 1-0 Sheffield United. Brian Dean in the middle of a scoring streak for the Blades. Sensational form at the moment.
It was different in the 80s, wasn't it? I mean, in downtime was completely different as well, you know.
Yeah.
The camaraderie
on the
was
lash.
Different. Yeah, well, I was going to ask you about that, you know, because what was it like, you know, going on those trips to Sweden, going on those trips away games, on the coach, old school characters all around you. Was it crate of beer, fish and chips, out on the lash every other night? What was the deal?
Oh, it was brilliant, honestly. That's all I can say. Guys, you're playing nowadays, listen, you earn a lot more money than we did, but we had a better time. You know, it was fantastic. I mean, those trips to Sweden were brilliant, you know, for all kinds of reasons. I mean, the football was good. It wasn't of a standard that was going to cause the problem, and it broke us into the season very well. But obviously on an evening, it was chaos. The whole kind of social side of it, you know, the beer was expensive. So, you know, it was just a great time. You know, and don't get me wrong, you know, we by and large, we behaved ourselves, but we were young guys, and we were in a hotel sometimes, and we were, you know, we were locked up doing our pre-season. You know, once we'd done our pre-season, we'd go, you know, for walks and so on. And sometimes we'd be down by the beach. It was just fantastic. I can't complain about anything that we had then. It was just a good time. And, you know, it was a great time to be a footballer. It meant a lot. Any of the guys will tell you, my age group will tell you that when they came into football, it was not about money. It was about waking up as a 10-year-old kid, looking at Roy of the Rovers, the back page of Roy of the Rovers, and it was signed. There was always a photo of a player, and it was signed, please. And it was like, you're supposed to take that to the player and get it signed. I wanted to be that person, you know, and I'm sure if you ask anybody, if you ask Shearer, if you ask Wrighty, Les, Gary Pallister, any of these, that's who you wanted to be. It was not about money. It was about, this was the one thing that we wanted to do more than anything. It really was. It was unbelievable.
Dean's in there. That's number two. Dean reading Hoyland's header beautifully well. And he's elated. Dean can't believe the ball he's in.
A striker can be seen as a bit of a headline hogger, the spearhead, the focal point of the team, the alpha male in the group. Was that you? Did you feel pressure to be that kind of character?
No, not at all. I think there's different things here. When I went to Sheffield United, nobody had any expectations of me, in that the guys kind of took me into the fold. There was a lot of the guys there were older than me, but they were great. They respected me for what I was bringing. There was no expectations. So I just saw that opportunity as something that we're a team. And that was the way how Dave Bassett built the whole situation. You know, we were a team. We conceded together. We scored together. I have to say that the guys in the changing room then were fantastic. And there was no ego. There was no alpha male. When I went to Leeds, that was a different situation because, you know, in the first year I was at Leeds, I struggled a little bit settling. They played a different type of football. I was used to getting the ball quickly, running at people. You know, I was asked to play more with my back to goal at Leeds, and I hated it. At the end of the first season, I had gone home and I was having an argument with my brother. And my brother said, listen, he said, what you need to do is you want to take some of your anger out on some of them teammates who aren't giving you the ball as quickly as, you're used to having it. Don't come here. I'd been used to just being the first line, and I went to Leeds and I tried to fit in. And I realised that second place is first loser. So when I went back in that summer, I decided that it's my rules now. I ain't taking no nonsense from anybody. I'm not going to, you know, feed off anybody's scraps anymore. I'm not going to be the guy who just, when nobody else has got a pass, they just bang it into me as hard as they can. And then I've got to deal with it. I thought, no, I'm not having that nonsense. And the thing was with that, was that when in the first year, I was having such a bad time. And I remember one time there was the goalkeeper kicked it out and I brought a ball down from it was straight from the goalkeeper's kick and I killed it dead. And I remember the crowd sort of like, it was almost like ironic cheers. Oh, blimey, you can do a bit. And those moments stick in your mind. And I said to myself, I went home that summer and I says, right, Brian, nobody anymore is going to have a free ride off my back. When we were at Sheffield United, we had a guy who used to come in and we used to do fitness conditioning. There's always a famous story about when we had 4 points at Christmas and we brought in a strength and conditioning guy called Ed Baranowski. And we worked hard. We worked harder than any other club in the country. So we went from having 4 points at Christmas, finishing about 12th, and we were rolling over teams at the end of that season. When I joined Leeds, I stopped being me. And in the end, there was an issue with my brother and I stripped it back and I said, okay, you got to get back to basics, Brian. And that's what I did. So I started to go and I went and I, at that time, nobody was doing any extra training. I know people come in and they talk about Arsene Wenger changed the culture. Nonsense. We were doing that at Sheffield United before anybody else, I'm telling you now. But we were just Sheffield United. You know, we weren't sexy enough for this story, but we were doing fitness, nutrition, all of that kind of stuff. And we needed to do it because we had to get any kind of little percentage uplift. We had to try and find it. We had to be creative.
And that's really interesting because I was looking back at a team photo from 1992-93 of Sheffield United, the team photo, and there is a sports psychologist in
Andrew Cale,
in the team photo. And also I have had the pleasure of a bit of company with Chris Wilder, and he said to me, you know, you underestimate the work that Dave Bassett used to do when he was in his prime. I mean, he was cutting up videotape and all sorts to do analysis. Listen, before it was even a thing,
I'll tell you now, you know, a lot of people take a lot of credit, and Harry over time has taken a bashing because people say, oh, Wimbledon, long ball, Sheffield United. Nonsense. That guy, right, is singly responsible. You know, it's like a lost art, because we started to have a lot of foreign coaches coming in. And obviously, they were doing it. And I don't know if it was that David decided he was going to take a different approach. But we were doing things to survive. We went away and Andy Cale was there. Andy Cale was a sports psychologist that we brought in. And we were playing, after we had our dinner on a Friday night, we were playing British Bulldog in a room. It was part of team bonding. It is crazy. This is what we talk about when we talk about siege mentality. This is what we talk about when...
So that was something to sort of get you all on the same side and all fighting for the same team. That was a technique, was it?
Absolutely. It's in the mind. It's the psychology of sport. You know, Harry was using all kinds of techniques to make sure that we could get the points that we needed.
Dorigo's cross just behind Whelan, trying to make something of it. Dazelle, in came speed. Chester Dean! Well, he's not the most likely goal scorer for Leeds all afternoon. As the frustration was starting to grow, a priceless goal for Leeds by Brian Dean.
You talked briefly about your time at Leeds. It was a huge price tag for you to go for. What was the spotlight like? Because it's a bit of a goldfish bowl, isn't it, Leeds? When, especially when you're the record signing and the number nine.
There were things that I struggled with. I think the fact that I was from Leeds was it was significant for me, because the kind of person I am and was at the time, very tactile and so on, I didn't want to fail. I didn't want to let anybody down. But by not being myself, I was letting myself down. I cut myself off. You know, I kind of went within myself. What I did was I used to overthink things. So I would sort of like go home and I'd think about training, and instead of just enjoying life, you know, and, you know, these are all experiences that you have, and you know when players are going through certain things in their career, you know, because you've been there yourself. And you know how to get over that. And that's what I was touching on with the psychology.
You've mentioned your brother a couple of times, and you said there was a problem with your brother. I mean, your brother appears, and I don't know this, I'm just going from what you're saying, to have been a huge influence on your career. Do you think that the frustrations you had when you were at Leeds early on, when you felt as if the weight of the world was on your shoulders, you didn't want to let anybody down, contributed to those problems?
He's still protective of me. Bless him, my dad's gone, but my dad said to Tony, make sure you look after that boy. That was before he died, you know, so Tony's always there. Tony's always going to be there. We don't always get on, you know, we have a difference of opinion. The closest people that you should have to you is family, because as my brother pointed out to me, when I fall, who's going to be there to pick me up? It's not going to be my agent. It's not going to be your friends. You know, it's going to be family, and that's important. Players nowadays have got to be so careful about the company they keep. You know, we all have regrets, but my brother has played an integral part in my success, and, you know, he's a great brother.
Now, in the 1990s, the idea of Benfica coming calling for an English player probably would have been slightly odd, weird. Didn't happen very often. I mean, it happened to yourself and it happened to Scott Minto. But what were the differences of the role of the number nine in Portugal compared to the role that you'd been so accustomed to in a fledgling Premier League?
I remember Graham Souness, who was my manager, said to me, you know, Brian, you know, you're out here because you're different. They don't know how to handle the likes of you. You know, when you're a player, sometimes you don't really understand what that means. You don't know how to take advantage of that because you're still young. You're in the middle of it and you're thinking, well, you know, okay, I'm not using it as part of my weaponry or my arsenal. But if perhaps I was a little bit more attentive or astute, perhaps I would have taken that on board and realised that when you go on a pitch, don't look at the opposition because they're looking at you and they're thinking, you know, wow, this is a guy I've got to play against today. Because when I went over there, I was huge compared to everybody else.
Physically, you're talking about.
Physically,
here.
Of course.
Not just in terms of publicity.
No. I was a different problem for a lot of the players. And even, I remember George Costa. You know, you remember they had the centre-back who played for Porto and he played for the national team, and he was supposed to be this animal. And I remember when we played Porto and I thought, God, this guy is supposed to be a monster, and the guy who played against next to him, he's a monster as well, and this is going to be tough. I know that because I played for England. One of my games was against Spain and I played against in Santander, and it was me, and I came on and played with Alan Shearer, and all I can remember about that was the centre-back just kicked lumps out of me for as long as I was on there. Guy called Lopez, and it was a tough game. You know, I think we got beat.
Spain were different then, right?
Yeah, it was the era of Goycochea. Your older listeners will remember that name because he's the guy who almost ended the career of Diego Maradona. Those guys were very good at the dark arts. I mean, they had black belts in the dark arts, you know. When I heard about, I'm going to play against Porto and this guy Costa, and I got on the pitch next to this guy, and this guy didn't even come up to my shoulder. And I thought, wow, You know, these guys must be looking at you thinking, I just want to get through these 90 minutes.
What was the overall experience like? How do you rate it? And can you speak Portuguese?
I can speak very little Portuguese. The overall experience was fantastic. If I'm honest, going over there, I have to tell people that the Europeans have a different view of the English, or they did do then, and that is that we have to earn their respect when we go abroad and play. I think what happens over here is they get respect as soon as they sign a contract. And I had to work my butt off to get the respect of all the Benfica fans and the players. You know, I left an indelible mark. You know, I remember I went on holiday to Mexico and there were some Benfica fans there and they were, Brian Dean, Benfica. And it's like, it was one of those things that in my career, it helped me to grow up. I actually wanted to go from Portugal to Spain. I wanted to go on into another league, but, I ended up coming back to Middlesbrough. But the overall experience, I would say, fantastic. The way of life. Portuguese people are so warm and friendly. I still keep in touch with one of my teammates, Paulo Madeira, a very dear friend of mine. He played for the national team as well as Benfica. And, you know, they're just warm people. I speak to Nuno Gomes now and again. You know, the team over there at the time, I mean, we had Brazilian internationals, Amaral. You know, Graham Souness is a funny guy in that, like, I like Graham. My experience with Graham was where if he didn't like you, he didn't like you. And he would make it pretty clear. For some reason, every day when he came in, Amaral was this, Sui didn't fancy him, so he never played. But he'd come in every day with his headphones on, listening to samba music. And I think that used to wind Sui up. but no, we had, you know, Michel Prudhomme was a goalkeeper at one. I think he got voted goalkeeper of the tournament in one of the World Cup tournaments.
Yeah,
he's
Belgian
still
guy.
Managing. That's right. You know, there were some extremely good players over there who went on and had stellar careers. And I went over there and I had to fit in and I had to scrap for everything. But it's one of those things that I was at my comfort zone and it was part of me building up my resilience. And, sometimes to become better players, and I've always said this, we need to get more players playing abroad. And obviously because of the financial situation, this is the most lucrative league. But until we get players going out there and playing in different leagues, we're not going to really get to the heights that we should do for the potential of the players that we've got. You know, the French do it, all their players go abroad, the Spanish do it, Argentinians, Brazilians, they all go back to the national team and bring something a little bit different back into the national team. And that's, I think we haven't got that guile and that little bit of street smartness in our country. We've even had to learn how to dive. Unfortunately, it's endemic in our game now, but I mean, I despair when I watch games now and I see people rolling over. And even when I went into management, I was like, I don't want any of my players rolling around because it's your identity as a person. Come on, get a grip.
Brian Dean opens his account. Leicester 1, Watford 0.
After you came back from Portugal, you went to Middlesbrough, then you went to Leicester, and it was another link up with Harry Bassett. And another first for you, because you scored the first competitive goal at the Walkers Stadium, which is now the King Power Stadium. It was another day that also had huge significance for Leicester, wasn't it?
There was a lot going on at the time. The NTL deal went south and it created all kinds of problems. But
that was
a TV
deal, wasn't it, in the early
2000s? Deal, that's right, yeah. The TV deal went, and you had a lot of players on big contracts that couldn't be supported from the deal in what is now the Championship. So it was a significant time. But yeah, I scored the first two goals there as well. So Jordan Stewart will tell you that it was him in the friendly against Barcelona, but they don't count. Nobody remembers that.
It's got to be the first competitive goal. You had a few brief moves at the end of your career. What were you doing? Were you looking for new experiences? Were you trying to earn money? Were you trying to keep the competitive juices flowing? What were you doing?
That's probably a good way of putting it. I was trying to keep the competitive juices flowing. You know, you get to 30, 31, you want to play as much football as possible. And when I went to West Ham, you know, that was another challenge for me because, you know, I think the West Ham fans at the time probably thought, who's this guy coming down? And, you know, I scored some goals pretty early in my career there, and that helped me to settle as well. That was quite tough, but it was a brilliant experience for me.
Here's Bernd Haas, comes inside, cut out again, Albion lose possession. Down this near left-hand side is Hutchinson, and Brian Deane has scored on his debut. West Ham 2 goals up inside 10 minutes.
Their fans can be vicious, but again, I was pretty fortunate. I think the funny thing was we had some players, I won't name names, but they used to, one of them in particular, really fun. No, I'm not gonna say it, but he was a left-footed player and he'd say, right, listen, if you win the toss, Christian, can you play sort of like on that side so that, you know, you're playing as a left footer, you'd be on the chicken run on that side so that when I come on, I won't get any stick. It was, honestly...
famous old chicken run at the bowling ground was brutal, wasn't it?
Brutal place, mate. You know what I mean? Yeah, I had a few moves. I wanted to play every minute of every game. I went back to Leeds when they came out of the Premier League. You know, there was a lot made of the time. There was a headline in the Yorkshire Post, and I'll never forget this, saying that I'd gone there on trial. I'm like, do you understand who I am? I'm coming to help you out. And you're turning around and saying that I'm coming on trial. It was nonsense. But, you know, I suppose journalists have to get their headlines in, you know. And once I was there, I thought, there's no way I'm just coming to make the numbers up. And that's what I'm talking about with resilience. You know, my personal pride wouldn't let me just sit out my career on the bench. The one mistake I made, I think, was going to, just before that, I went to Sunderland, and Mick McCarthy, a brilliant guy, by the way, what a bloke, honest manager, you know, and he was just all round good guy. I came at transfer deadline, they said, look, Brian, I want you here because I think you can have a good impact. I think you can be good around the changing room for us. I'm not going to offer you a contract at the end of the season, but I want you to come here and do a job for us. We're going for a promotion. And he was very honest with me. And I think as a player, that's all you want from a manager. You just want honesty. And he said that. I walked out at the end of that. I went to Australia. And that was a mistake for a number of reasons.
Going to Australia was the mistake. Why was going to Australia the mistake?
My preparation was poor. I didn't do a pre-season. The league was in its first year. And to be honest, the standard was terrible, you know, and I didn't settle. I wasn't fit enough. I drew a line under it when I remember we were in Perth and we had a league game in Wellington in New Zealand. And I thought, so if you think about that, I remember getting on, I thought, I've got friends in Miami. It'd be quicker for me to go to Miami for two, three days. And I've got to go and play a game in Wellington. So it was a 5-hour flight to Sydney and then another 4 or 5 hours, got my keys to my bedroom and it was a single bed and I thought, Brian, it's over, go home. I thought, I can't do this no more. I was 37 at the time and I thought, what are you doing here? Do you really love football that much? And I remember at the time the centre back was a young guy and he was quicker. I just thought the pitch was big. People were knocking the ball into the channels. I couldn't run out. So, what are you doing, Brian?
You've been listening to Upfront with Brian Deane and me, Sam Matterface. And if you missed any of the show or just want to catch up on previous episodes from the series, you can listen on the TalkSport app via the Game Day podcast feed.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. The latest odds? We set them. Form guides? We've got them. Expert opinions? We share them. The best fans in the world deserve the best. Be match day ready before the whistle blows with Ladbrokes. Odds update on Talk Sport with Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com. 18 plus. Be gambleaware.org. T's and C's apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.